Für alle ein Fest. Zum Aldi-Tiefpreis. Diese Woche Funny Frisch Chips Frisch. 150 Gramm für nur 88 Cent. Oder Langnese Cremissimo. Ab 825 Milliliter für nur 1,49 Euro. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
Welcome to the State of the Race. It is March 15th, 2024. We are 123 days until the Republican National Convention, 158 days until the Democratic National Convention, and 235 days until the general election. Coming up in this episode, we have RFK Jr.'s Veep shortlist, which is interesting to say the least. We have the State of the Union polling bump for Joe Biden, or lack thereof, and we have the racial realignment of today's political parties, which is fascinating. But first, our key metrics. What actually happened with the State of the Union? We were told this was an incredible achievement for President Biden. And if you watched the speech, you do know he stayed awake for all of it, which was an achievement. He didn't fall over at any point. Sure, he disrupted relations with one of our closest allies, Israel, in a supposedly off-mic moment. But generally speaking, he got through it and did the best that you could ever expect out of Joe Biden. I mean, it was filled with lies and he was terrible, but that was what you'd expect. But you're told this is going to give a big bump to Biden as he came out of the speech. And really what we're seeing is not much of a bump at all. 538 reporting, Biden has seen no State of the Union poll bump yet. Maybe there's one to come in the near future. Who knows? But they say today's updated approval rating, this is a couple days ago now, March 13th, I think it was, March 12th, March 13th. It was, it actually showed Joe Biden and his approval rating average at an all-time low. Yet another Biden's newest low, 37.4%. We've gone through these numbers before, but you're around 44, 45%. You got a decent chance of getting reelected. And, you know, above 50, really good chance of being elected. Anything other lower than the low 40s, you're in serious trouble. In fact, if I remember the analysis right, no president with an approval rating that low has been reelected. And of course, that's where Joe Biden stands today. Of course, the media is going to do everything they can to try to turn that around. But the prediction markets are seeing this the same way as well. Donald Trump with a 52% chance to win the presidency. Joe Biden, 37%. This is according to Polymarket, one of the prediction forums where you can make money off of, you know, put your money where your mouth is, basically. And we're talking about, just to give you a general sense, you know, adding this up here, you know, there's probably $30, $40 million that has been wagered on this particular market. And, you know, people believe Joe Biden, you know, obviously 52 to 37, that's a 15-point margin, but it also only adds up to 89%. The people who are putting their money where their mouth is are allowing for a very large possibility that still someone else is going to step in and win this. They're all very low percentage chances. RFK Jr., of course, Michelle Obama, Gavin Newsom, Kamala Harris, all very low, but that is where we stand right now. Let's go through some of the quick candidate updates. Of course, Fani Willis was the big story over the past couple of weeks. She's the district attorney down there in Georgia trying to come after Donald Trump. And she presented this bizarre defense of herself where she forced herself onto the stand against the wishes of her attorneys and basically gave a long, sassy sort of response to all of these allegations that she was sleeping with the lawyer that she hired. Now, of course, she had to admit she was actually sleeping with the lawyer that she hired, but she had to say it happened after they started working together because inner office affairs are so much better than affairs that happen when you're not working together, I think, is the lesson of Me Too. I'm a little confused that whole period, frankly. But generally speaking, what you see is a ruling that came out today, and the best case scenario for Trump was they would throw Fani Willis off of this case, because if that happened, basically the whole office would have to be pulled off the case. You'd at the very least see long delays until they named new people. Everyone needs to get up to speed. Probably nothing happens before the election. He did not get that ruling. What he got basically was a half and half. The judge said, basically, we don't see the evidence that shows that Fani Willis was doing this as her prime motivation for financial benefit, which was what the Trump attorneys and other defendants were alleging. He said basically, look, she makes a lot of money already. She already makes a couple hundred thousand dollars a year. He makes a lot of money already. They were dating. They were probably going to go on these trips anyway. Look, I don't agree with his reasoning there, but basically he said, I'm limited by that. I can't go any deeper than that. I can't say that I can't throw her off of this because we don't have absolute proof this was her motivation. Okay. All right. I don't agree with that analysis. I mean, I don't think that was her full motivation by any means, but it did seem like the nice trips to Napa Valley and Belize were kind of maybe a nice perk of having her boyfriend work with her. I think the bigger thing was that she lied directly to the court, and usually the court does not like that. And honestly, when it's not the headline of this hearing, but when you read on and read the whole thing, you do get the sense that the judge was pretty pissed about this. Let me give you this one excerpt, and I think this is the most important part of what he released. He says, without sufficient evidence that the district attorney acquired a personal stake in the prosecution or that her financial arrangements had any impact on the case, the defendant's claims of an actual conflict must be denied. This finding is by no means an indication that the court condones this tremendous lapse in judgment or the unprofessional manner of the district attorney's testimony during the evidentiary hearing. That is a really important part of this. He's not saying, well, you had a lapse in judgment, you were sleeping with one of your underlings, or, you know, you had a lapse in judgment, you didn't keep records of these financial transactions. It's, you had a lapse in judgment, you had an unprofessional performance in your testimony during the evidentiary hearing. He says, this is interesting, it is important for the court to confine itself to the relevant issues and applicable law. And he says the Georgia law does not permit the finding of an actual conflict for, as he calls it, simply making bad choices even repeatedly. However, he goes on to lay out a roadmap as to some other organizations that might not be in very liberal districts to make a difference. He says other forms or sources of authority, such as the General Assembly, the Georgia State Ethics Commission, the State Bar of Georgia, the Fulton County Board of Commissioners, or the voters of Fulton County may offer feedback on any unanswered questions that linger. And there are plenty of those questions. And if you got some extra time, maybe calling, I don't know, the Georgia State Ethics Commission might be a good idea to check that out, because they really should be doing something. Now, on the other side, Joe Biden has stuff going on as well. In fact, he's raising money in something that I'm sure is going to raise maybe hundreds of millions of dollars. Hillary Clinton and Lin-Manuel Miranda are hosting a Broadway fundraiser for Joe Biden's presidential campaign next month that will feature a performance of Suffs the Musical. Yes, Suffs the Musical. What is that, you ask? Oh, it gets better from here. The musical, which Clinton is co-producing, good God almighty, focuses on women's suffrage. So if you want to see a Hillary Clinton-produced Broadway play about women's suffrage and donating to Joe Biden's campaign at the same time, first of all, you're a stronger person than I am. But secondly, you can do that apparently next month. Good luck with the rest of your life. Also, RFK Jr. is going to be picking his VP candidate in the next couple of weeks. Lots of reporting on who he's been asking. In recent months, Mr. Kennedy and his camp have approached at least a half dozen people with varying degrees of formality to gauge their interest. We're talking about quarterback of the New York Jets, Aaron Rodgers, former governor of Minnesota, Jesse Ventura, former representative and Bernie Sanders acolyte, Tulsi Gabbard, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, and Andrew Yang, the former candidate and former New York mayoral candidate and presidential candidate. Those are just some of the people. I've heard actually a couple of others as well, though not confirmed. I don't know how public it is, so I'm not going to go into all of that. But bottom line is he's going to a lot of really famous people, and he's trying to convince them, hey, like, come on my ticket. We're going to make a splash here. Look, I don't know that Aaron Rodgers has any reason to be named vice president of the United States. And certainly I don't believe RFK Jr. should be president of the United States under any circumstances. Please look up his views on global warming before you embrace him, even if you like a couple of his viewpoints. The guy's, I mean, not the guy we need to lead this country, in my opinion. Okay, last one. Today's focus, we are going to look into the racial realignment and really complete political realignment of the country, which is going on in front of our eyes. And this has been rumored for a long time. Every presidential candidate likes to say they're going to be able to alter this. Donald Trump certainly claimed this. He's one of the first people in a while that actually has a claim to it. Now, this isn't all Donald Trump's doing. It seemingly has been changing over a very long period of time. But man, it really is changing now. This is real. This is a real thing. We've heard this for a long time, that black voters, Hispanic voters are going to be changing. They have different values. It really does seem to be real this time. This is an analysis done by the Financial Times and John Byrne Murdoch. And it's really fascinating. If you look at the percentage of non-white Americans and their vote intention for presidential elections, if you go back to the 60s, you see really like it's almost all Democrats, close to 100% Democrats. And over the years, it's moved quite a bit. It dropped certainly a lot in 1984 for Ronald Reagan, kind of stayed flat for a while until about 2016 with some ebbs and flows. And then you see a major drop from about 80% supporting Democrats, now down to maybe 55. We've become a 55-45 when it comes to the non-white vote in this country. And this is good news, obviously, for Republicans generally, though with some caveats. We'll get into those in a second. What are the groups and how are they changing? Well, really, the biggest changes are happening among Hispanic and black voters. Now, white college voters are moving toward Democrats slightly. Older voters are moving toward Democrats slightly. Asian voters, those between really anywhere from 18 to 64, all moving toward Republicans. The younger voter, the younger the voter in this poll, the more they are moving towards Republicans. Again, this is a narrative forever that Republicans don't win the young voters. Well, that is changing. But among Hispanic and black voters, it's really changing. A 20-point jump toward Republicans for black for Hispanic voters, and a 25-point jump for black voters. This is a massive, massive change. The income divide is also changing as well. It's not just racial. It's not just age. The income divide is changing. For a very, very long time, Republicans have done very well among the richest third of voters. They have won those voters by 20 points since really the late 70s into the 80s, all the way till Mitt Romney basically ran for president. Then between 2012 and on, you see a major difference where the Democrats were winning poorer voters by about 20 points. We were about tied in the middle class, and we have the Republicans winning richer voters by about 20 points. That's changed now. Basically, all three categories are right around even now. It's about a 20-point difference, a drop-off among Democratic voters when it comes to the poor, a drop-off among Republican voters when it comes to the rich, and the middle class pretty much staying flat, although going a little bit towards Republicans. This is where I would say you have a little bit of concern. And it's not because you don't want poor voters. It's not because you do want rich voters. It's not because you don't want young voters. And it's not because you do want older voters. Everybody's vote counts the same. And it's not because you do want white voters or you don't want black voters. The only issue here is historically, and these things are still holding much more than the actual political allegiances, these voters that the Republicans are gaining in, while important, are also not as reliable a voter. They are not, historically, for a long time, you see white voters, older voters, and more wealthy voters be the ones that are more reliably at the polls, particularly in off-year elections. With poorer voters, with minority voters, with younger voters, they just don't tend to be as engaged, statistically, and they don't tend to be at the polls as often, as reliably. You know, one of the reasons why Republicans love playing to older voters is because they show up. They always watch. They always care. They always show up. They always vote. And so going after those voters is really, really important. Well, the Republicans are starting to do a really good job now appealing to those groups they've never been able to appeal to. However, if your coalition is built on voters who don't go to the polls, you wind up losing a lot. And if you want to go back, and you can see this happen in historical elections where Republicans won, Democrats relied too heavily on groups of voters who didn't actually show up. Oh, of course the 18-year-olds are going to come out and vote against Ronald Reagan and vote against George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. Well, a lot of times they didn't, and that became a massive problem. This is going too long, but I have a couple quick other things to do, which is interesting. Number one, the black voter change is fascinating because voters who are older among black voters are sticking with Democrats. The ones that were there in the 60s, the ones that were there for the civil rights era, they are saying, we're sticking with the Democrats, ride or die with the Dems. It's the younger black voters that are saying, why are we doing this? Like, I don't understand. They've forgotten what happened in the civil rights era, and they've seen what Democrats are doing today when it comes to race, and they don't like it so much. They're coming over to the Republicans. And it's funny because when you look at all the different groups, you find this over time. Going back for a very long period of time, you could predict how different groups would vote based on their ideology. That makes a lot of sense. If you happen to be a guy who wants small government, you happen to be a guy who wants lower taxes, you're probably going to vote Republican. You happen to be someone who's pro-life, you're probably going to vote Republican. That was pretty consistent among all racial groups, with one exception, which were African Americans, who tended to vote against their ideology. This kind of connects to the sort of emotional connection to the civil rights days of yore, where this group who was doing things that they liked in the 60s, they liked those things in the 60s so much that they stuck with them through the Democrats through the 80s and 90s and 2000s. And that was kind of true for a very long time, even through 2012 and at some degree 2016. In 2020 and 2022, what we have seen is a much closer alignment with black voters and what they actually believe. Many of these voters are not for the LGBTQIA2+ sort of extremes that we see from the media. They're not for the pro-choice extremes. And they're starting to see those values, those ideas, the things they believe as associating with much more closely with what they should vote for rather than just their identity or maybe what their parents voted for. This is a positive, obviously, for Republicans, but you can't lose all your other voters and trade these guys out because then you wind up either in a wash or losing some in that particular battle. John Byrne Murdoch points this out as he finishes up his tweet thread on this, which was pretty fascinating. We'll tweet it out as well at Studios America. The left's challenge with non-white voters is much deeper than it first appears. A less racially divided America is an America where people will vote more based on their beliefs than their identity. This is a big challenge for Dems. Now, he's not saying what I'm about to say, but I believe this is true. This is a good reason for Democrats to prioritize keeping that racial divide going. You always see this and you're wondering, why are they constantly inflaming racial divides? Why does this happen? Well, if people are thinking about the racial divides and they're picking a side based on racial divides, they're not analyzing as closely their actual viewpoints and their actual values. They're making a decision based on something that happened 50 years ago. That's what the Democrats want. Instead, that's changing now, and Democrats are in real trouble because of it. We have so much more coming up. We're going to be doing a lot of this, of course, on radio. We'll get into it maybe a little bit more next week. And, of course, on Stu Does America, which you can get right here on this particular stream, also on YouTube as well. Make sure to check it out. Thanks so much for joining us. This has been the State of the Race.